She passed away 6 years ago.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Me too. We all miss her. My mom did especially. That's why she got along so well with Aaron. They even looked alike. Same age and everything. If Karen noticed Kevin's blank expression, she gave no sign. My mom used to show Aaron the scrapbook she'd put together about Katie. She was always so patient with my mom. She's a sweet woman. You're a lucky man. Kevin forced himself to smile.
Yes, I know.
He'd been a good detective, but in truth, sometimes the answers came down to luck. New evidence surfacing, an unknown witness stepping forward, a street camera catching a license plate. In this case, the lead came from a woman in black named Karen Feldman, who crossed the street on a morning he'd been drinking and told him about her dead sister. Even though his head still ached, he poured the vodka down the drain and thought about Aaron and the Feldmans. Aaron knew them and visited them, even though she'd never mentioned going to their house. He'd called her and dropped by unexpectedly, and she'd always been home, but somehow he'd never found out. She'd never told him, and when he'd complained that they were bad neighbors, she'd never said a word. Aaron had a secret. His mind was clearer than it had been in a long time, and he got in the shower and washed and put on a black suit. He made a ham and turkey sandwich with Dijon mustard and ate it, then made another and ate it as well. The street was filled with cars, and he watched people walking in and out of the house. Karen came outside and smoked another cigarette. While he waited, he tucked a small pad of paper and a pen in his pocket. In the afternoon, people started filing toward their cars. He heard the engines start up, and one by one they began to pull away. It was past 1 o'clock, and they were going to the service. It took 15 minutes for everyone to leave, and he saw Larry Feldman being helped to the car by Karen. Karen got into the driver's seat and drove off, and finally there were no more cars on the street or in the driveway. He waited 10 more minutes, making sure everyone had left before finally walking out his front door. He crossed his lawn and paused at the street and headed for the Feldman's house. He didn't hurry and didn't try to hide. He'd noticed that a lot of neighbors had gone to the funeral, and those who hadn't would simply remember a mourner wearing a black suit. He went to the front door and it was locked, but there had been a lot of people in the house, so he walked around the side and headed to the back. There he found another door, and it was unlocked, and he stepped into the house. It was quiet. He paused, listening for the sound of voices or footsteps, but heard nothing. There were plastic cups on the countertop and platters of food on the table. He walked through the house. He had time, but he didn't know how much time, and he decided to start in the living room. He opened cabinet doors and closed them, leaving everything the way it had been before. He searched in the kitchen and the bedroom and finally went to the study. There were books on the shelves and a recliner and a television. In the corner, he spotted a small file cabinet. He went to the file cabinet and opened it. Quickly, he scanned the tabs. He found a file labeled Katie and pulled it out, opened it, and examined what was inside. There was a newspaper article. It turns out that she'd drowned after breaking through the ice of a local pond, and there were pictures of her that had been taken at school. In her graduation photo, she looked remarkably like Aaron. In the back of the file, he found an envelope. He opened it and found an old report card. On the front of the envelope was a social security number, and he took the pad of paper and his pen and wrote it down. He didn't find the social security card, but he had the number. The birth certificate was a copy, though it was wrinkled and worn, as if someone had crumpled it up and then tried to flatten it again. He had what he needed, and he left the house. As soon as he reached home, he called the officer from the other precinct, the one who was sleeping with the babysitter. The following day, he received a call in return. Katie Feldman had recently been issued a driver's license with an address listed in Southport, North Carolina.
Kevin hung up the phone without another word, knowing he'd found her. Aaron. Chapter 31. Remnants of a tropical storm blew through Southport, rain falling most of the afternoon and into the evening. Katie worked the lunch shift, but the weather kept the restaurant only half full, and Ivan let her leave early. She had borrowed the Jeep, and after spending an hour at the library, she'd dropped it off at the store. When Alex drove her home, she'd invited him to come by later with the kids for dinner. She'd been on edge the rest of the afternoon. She wanted to believe it had something to do with the weather, but as she stood at her kitchen window, watching the branches bend in the wind and rain falling in sheets, she knew it had more to do with the uneasy feeling that everything in her life these days seemed almost too perfect. Her relationship with Alex and the afternoon she spent with the kids filled a void she hadn't known existed. But she'd learned long ago that nothing wonderful lasted forever. Joy was as fleeting as a shooting star that crossed the evening sky, ready to blink out at any moment. Earlier that day, at the library, she'd perused the Boston Globe online at one of the computers and had come across Gladys Feldman's obituary. She'd known Gladys was ill, had known about her terminal diagnosis of cancer before she left. Even though she'd been checking the Boston obituaries regularly, the sparse description of her life and survivors struck her with unexpected force. She hadn't wanted to take the identification from the Feldman's files, hadn't even considered the possibility until Gladys had pulled out the file to show her Katie's graduation photo. She'd seen the birth certificate and the social security card next to the photo and recognized the opportunity they presented. The next time she'd gone to the house, she'd excused herself to go to the bathroom and had gone to the file cabinet instead. Later, as she ate blueberry pie with them in the kitchen, the documents felt like they were burning in her pockets. A week later, after making a copy of the birth certificate at the library and folding and wrinkling it to make it appear dated, she put the document in the file. She would have done the same with the Social Security card, but she couldn't make a good enough copy, and she hoped that if they noticed it was missing, they would believe it had been lost or misplaced. She reminded herself that Kevin would never know what she'd done. He didn't like the Feldmans, and the feeling was mutual. She suspected that they knew he beat her. She could see it in their eyes as they watched her dart across the road to visit them, in the way they pretended never to notice the bruises on her arms, in the way their faces tightened whenever she mentioned Kevin. She wanted to think that they would have been okay with what she'd done, that they would have wanted her to take the identification, because they knew she needed it and wanted her to escape. They were the only people she missed from Dorchester, and she wondered how Larry was doing. They were her friends when she had no one else, and she wanted to tell Larry that she was sorry for his loss. She wanted to cry with him and talk about Gladys, and to tell him that because of them, her life was better now. She wanted to tell him that she'd met a man who loved her, that she was happy for the first time in years. But she would do none of those things. Instead, she simply stepped out onto the porch and, through eyes that were blurry with tears, watched the storm tear leaves from the trees.
"You've been quiet tonight," Alex said. "Is everything okay?"
She'd made tuna casserole for dinner, and Alex was helping her with the dishes. The kids were in the living room, both of them playing handheld computer games. She could hear the beeps and buzzes over the sound of the faucet. "A friend of mine passed away," she said. She handed him a plate to dry. "I knew it was coming, but it's still sad."
"It's always sad," he agreed. "I'm sorry."
He knew enough not to ask for further details. Instead, he waited on the chance she wanted to say more, but she washed another glass and changed the subject. "How long do you think the storm is going to last?" she asked.
"Not long. Why?"
"I was just wondering whether the carnival tomorrow is going to be canceled, or whether the flight is going to be canceled." Alex glanced out the window.
"It should be fine. It's already blowing through. I'm pretty sure we're on the tail end of it now."
"Just in time," Katie remarked.
"Of course. The elements wouldn't dare mess with the well-laid plans of the carnival committee. Or Joyce, for that matter.
She smiled. How long is it going to take you to pick up Joyce's daughter?
Probably 4 or 5 hours. Raleigh's not exactly convenient to this place.
Why didn't she fly into Wilmington? Or just rent a car?
I don't know. I didn't ask. But if I had to guess, I'd say she wanted to save some money.
You're doing a good thing, you know, helping Joyce like that. He gave a nonchalant shrug, indicating that it wasn't a big deal.
You'll have fun tomorrow.
At the carnival or with the kids?
Both. And if you ask me nice, I'll treat you to some deep-fried ice cream.
Fried ice cream? It sounds disgusting.
It's actually tasty.
Is everything fried down here?
If it can be fried, believe me, someone will find a way. Last year, there was a place serving deep-fried butter.
She almost gagged. You're kidding.
Nope. It sounds terrible, but people were lining up to buy it. They might as well have been lining up for heart attacks.
She washed and rinsed the last of the cups, then passed it to him. Do you think the kids liked the dinner I made? Kristen didn't eat very much.
Kristen never eats much. And more important, I liked it. I thought it was delicious.
She shook her head. Who cares about the kids, right? As long as you're happy.
I'm sorry. I'm a narcissist at heart.
She ran the soapy sponge over a plate and rinsed it. I'm looking forward to spending some time at your house.
Why?
Because we're always here, not there. Don't get me wrong. I understand it was the right thing to do because of the kids. And because of Carly, she also thought. But she didn't mention that part. It'll give me the chance to see how you live. Alex took the plate.
You've been there before.
Yes, but not for more than a few minutes, and then only in the kitchen or living room. It's not like I've had the chance to check out your bedroom or peek in your medicine cabinet.
You wouldn't do that.
Alex feigned outrage. Maybe if I had the chance, I might. He dried the plate and put it in the cupboard.
Feel free to spend as much time in my bedroom as you like.
She laughed. You're such a man.
I'm just saying that I wouldn't mind. And feel free to peek in the medicine cabinet, too. I have no secrets.
So you say, she teased. You're talking to someone who only has secrets.
Not from me.
No, she agreed, her face serious. Not from you. She washed 2 more plates and handed them to him, feeling a wave of contentment wash over her as she watched him dry and put them away. He cleared his throat.
Can I ask you something? He said. I don't want you to take it the wrong way, but I've been curious.
Go ahead. He used the towel on his arms, dabbing at stray droplets, buying time.
I was wondering if you'd given more thought to what I said last weekend, in the parking lot, after seeing the rodeo monkeys.
You said a lot of things, she said cautiously.
Don't you remember? You told me that Aaron couldn't get married, but I said that Katie probably could.
Katie felt herself stiffen, less at the memory than at the serious tone he was using. She knew exactly where this was leading. I remember, she said, with forced lightness. I think I said I would have to meet the right guy. At her words, his lips tightened, as if he were debating whether to continue.
I just wanted to know if you thought about it. Us eventually getting married, I mean.
The water was still warm as she started on the silverware. You'd have to ask first.
But if I did?
She found a fork and scrubbed it. I suppose I'd tell you that I love you.
Would you say yes?
She paused. I don't want to get married again.
You don't want to? Or you don't think you can?
What's the difference? Her expression remained stubborn, closed. You know I'm still married. Bigamy is illegal.
You're not Aaron anymore. You're Katie. As you pointed out, your driver's license proves it.
But I'm not Katie either, she snapped before turning toward him. Don't you get that? I stole that name from people I cared about. People who trusted me. She stared at him, feeling the surge of tension from earlier in the day, recalling with fresh intensity Gladys's kindness and pity, her escape, and the nightmarish years with Kevin. Why can't you just be happy with the way things are? Why do you have to push so hard for me to be the person you want me to be rather than the person that I am? He flinched.
I love the person that you are.
But you're making it conditional.
I'm not.
But you are, she insisted. She knew she was raising her voice, but she couldn't seem to stop it. You have this idea of what you want in life, and you're trying to make me fit into it.
I don't, Alex protested. I simply asked you a question.
But you wanted a specific answer. You wanted the right answer, and if you didn't get it, you were going to try to convince me otherwise. That I should do what you want. That I should do everything you want.
For the first time ever, Alex narrowed his eyes at her. Don't do this, he said.
Do what? Tell the truth? Tell you how I feel? Why? What are you going to do? Hit me? Go ahead.
He physically recoiled as though she'd slapped him. She knew her words had hit their mark. But instead of getting angry, Alex set the dish towel on the counter and took a step backward. I don't know what's going on, but I'm sorry that I even brought it up. I didn't mean to put you on the spot or try to convince you of anything. I was just trying to have a conversation.
He paused, waiting for her to say something, but she stayed silent. Shaking his head, he started to leave the kitchen before coming to a stop.
Thank you for dinner, he whispered.
In the living room, she heard him tell the kids it was getting late, heard the front door open with a squeak. He closed the door softly behind him, and the house was suddenly quiet, leaving her alone with her thoughts. Chapter 32. Kevin was having trouble staying between the lines on the highway. He'd wanted to keep his mind sharp, but his head had begun to pound, and he'd been sick to his stomach, so he'd stopped at a liquor store and bought a bottle of vodka. It numbed the pain, and as he sipped it through a straw, all he could think about was Erin and how she'd changed her name to Katie. The interstate was a blur. Headlights, double pinpricks of white, rose in intensity as they approached from the opposite direction and then vanished when they passed him. One after another, thousands, people going places, doing things. Kevin driving to North Carolina, heading south to find his wife, leaving Massachusetts, driving through Rhode Island and Connecticut, New York and New Jersey. The moon rose, orange and angry, before turning white, and crossed the blackened sky above him, stars overhead. Hot wind blew through the open window, and Kevin held the wheel steady, his thoughts a jigsaw of mismatched pieces. The bitch had left him. She'd abandoned the marriage and left him to rot, and believed she was smarter than he was. But he'd found her. Karen Feldman had crossed the street, and he'd learned that Erin had a secret. But not anymore. He knew where Erin lived. He knew where she was hiding. Her address was scribbled on a piece of paper on the seat beside him, held in place by the Glock he'd brought from home. On the back seat was a duffel bag filled with clothes and handcuffs and duct tape. On his way out of town, he stopped at an ATM and withdrew a few $100s. He wanted to smash Erin's face with his fists as soon as he found her, bloody it to an ugly pulp. He wanted to kiss her and hold her and beg her to come home. He filled the tank near Philadelphia and remembered how he'd tracked her there. She'd made a fool of him, carrying on a secret life he hadn't even known about, visiting the Feldmans, cooking and cleaning for them while she plotted and schemed and lied. What else, he wondered, had she lied about? A man? Maybe not then, but there had to be a man by now. Kissing her, caressing her, taking her clothes off, laughing at him. They were probably in bed together right now, her and the man, both of them laughing at him behind his back. I showed him, didn't I? She was saying as she laughed. Kevin didn't even see it coming. It made him crazy to think about. Furious. He'd been on the road for hours already, but Kevin kept driving.
He sipped his vodka and blinked rapidly to clear his vision. He didn't speed, didn't want to get pulled over. Not with a gun on the seat beside him. She was afraid of guns, and always asked him to lock his up when he finished his shift, which he did. But it wasn't enough. He could buy her a house, furniture, and pretty clothes, and take her to the library and the hair salon, and it still wasn't enough. Who could understand it? Was it so hard to clean the house and cook dinner? He never wanted to hit her, only did it when he had no other choice, when she was stupid or careless or selfish. She brought it on herself. The engine droned, the noise steady in his ears. She had a driver's license now, and she was a waitress at a restaurant called Ivan's. Before he left, he'd spent some time on the internet and had made some calls. It hadn't been hard to track her down because the town was small. It took him less than 20 minutes to find out where she worked. All he had to do was dial the number and ask if Katie was there. On the fourth call, someone said yes. He hung up without a word. She thought she could hide forever. But he was a good detective, and he'd found her. "I'm coming," he thought to himself. "I know where you live and where you work, and you won't get away again." He passed billboards and exit ramps, and in Delaware, the rain started to fall. He rolled up the window and felt the wind begin to push the car sideways. A truck ahead of him was swerving, the trailer wheels riding the lines. He turned on the wipers and the windshield cleared, but the rain began to fall even harder, and he leaned over the wheel, squinting into the fuzzy orbs of oncoming headlights. His breath began to fog the glass, and he turned on the defroster. He would drive all night and find Aaron tomorrow. He'd bring her home, and they'd start over again. Man and wife, living together, the way it was supposed to be. Happy. They used to be happy. Used to do fun things together. Early on in the marriage, he remembered he and Aaron would visit open houses on the weekends. She was excited about buying a house, and he would listen as she talked to the realtors, her voice trilling like music in the empty homes. She liked to take her time as she walked through the rooms, and he knew she was imagining where to put furniture. When they found the house in Dorchester, he'd known she wanted it by the way her eyes were sparkling. That night, lying in bed, she traced small circles on his chest as she pleaded with him to make an offer. And he could remember thinking that he would do anything she wanted because he loved her. Except have children. She'd told him that she wanted kids, wanted to start a family. In the first year of marriage, she'd talked about it all the time. He tried to ignore her, didn't want to tell her that he didn't want her to get fat and puffy, that pregnant women were ugly, that he didn't want to hear her whining about how tired she was or how her feet were swollen. He didn't want to hear a baby fussing and crying when he got home from work, didn't want toys scattered around the house. He didn't want her to get frumpy and saggy, or hear her ask him whether he thought her butt was getting fat. He married her because he wanted a wife, not a mother. But she kept bringing it up, kept harping day after day until he finally slapped her and told her to shut up. After that, she never talked about it again. But now he wondered whether he should have given her what she wanted. She wouldn't have left if she had a child, wouldn't have been able to run away in the first place. By the same token, she could never run away again. They would have a child, he decided, and the three of them would live in Dorchester and he would work as a detective. In the evenings, he'd come home to his pretty wife, and when people saw them in the grocery store, they would marvel and say, "They look like the all-American family." He wondered whether her hair was blonde again, hoped it was long and blonde and that he could run his fingers through it. She liked when he did that, always whispering to him, saying the words he liked, turning him on. But it hadn't been real, not if she'd been planning to leave him, not if she hadn't come back. She'd lied to him, been lying all along, for weeks, months even, stealing from the Feldmans, the cell phone, taking money from his wallet, scheming and plotting, and he'd had no idea at all, and now another man was sharing her bed, running his fingers through her hair, listening to her moans, feeling her hands on him. Kevin bit his lip and tasted blood, hating her, wanting to kick and punch her, wanting to throw her down the stairs. He took another sip from the bottle next to him, rinsing the metallic taste from his mouth. She'd fooled him because she was beautiful. Everything about her was pretty. Her breasts, her lips, even the small of her back. At the casino in Atlantic City, when he'd first met her, he'd thought she was the prettiest woman he'd ever seen. And in their 4 years of marriage, nothing had changed. She knew he desired her, and she used it to her advantage. Dressing sexy, getting her hair done, wearing lacy underwear. It made him lower his guard, made him think she loved him. But she didn't love him. She didn't even care about him. She didn't care about the broken flower pots and smashed up china, didn't care that he'd been suspended from his job, didn't care that he'd cried himself to sleep for months, didn't care that his life was falling apart. All that mattered was what she wanted, but she'd always been selfish, and now she was laughing at him, laughing for months and thinking only about herself. He loved her and hated her, and he couldn't make sense of it. He felt tears beginning to form, and he blinked them back. Delaware. Maryland. The outskirts of Washington, D.C. Virginia. Hours lost to the never-ending night. Raining hard at first, then gradually the rain dissipated. He stopped near Richmond at dawn and ate breakfast. 2 eggs, 4 pieces of bacon, wheat toast. He drank 3 cups of coffee. He put more gas in the car and went back to the interstate. He crossed into North Carolina under blue skies. Bugs were cemented against the windshield, and his back had begun to ache. He had to wear sunglasses to keep from squinting, and his whiskers had begun to itch. "I'm coming, Aaron," he thought. "I'll be there soon." Chapter 33. Katie awoke exhausted. She had tossed and turned for hours during the night, replaying the horrible things she'd said to Alex. She didn't know what had come over her. Yes, she was upset about the Feldmans, but for the life of her, she couldn't remember how the argument had started in the first place. Or rather, she did remember, but it didn't make sense. She'd known he hadn't been pressuring her or trying to force her to do anything she wasn't ready for. She knew he wasn't remotely like Kevin. But what had she said to him? "What are you going to do? Hit me? Go ahead." Why would she have said something like that? She eventually dozed off sometime after 2 a.m., when the wind and rain were beginning to taper off. By dawn, the sky was clear and birdsong was drifting from the trees. From the porch, she noticed the effects of the storm. Broken branches strewn out front, a carpet of pine cones littered across the yard and drive. The air was already thick with humidity. It was going to be a scorcher, maybe the hottest day of the summer yet. She made a note to herself to remind Alex not to keep the kids out in the sun too long, before she realized that he might not want her with them, that maybe he was still mad at her. Not maybe, she corrected herself. He was almost certainly mad at her, and hurt as well. He hadn't even let the kids say goodbye last night. She took a seat on the steps and turned toward Joe's, wondering if she was up and about. It was early, probably too early to knock on her door. She didn't know what she would say to her or what good it would do. She wouldn't tell her what she'd said to Alex. That was a memory she'd rather erase in its entirety. But maybe Joe could help her understand the anxiety she'd been feeling. Even after Alex left, she noted the tension in her shoulders. And last night, for the first time in weeks, she'd wanted the light on. Her intuition told her that something was wrong, but she couldn't pinpoint what it was, other than that her thoughts kept returning to the Feldmans, to Gladys.
to the inevitable changes in the house. What would happen if someone realized Katie's information was missing? Simply imagining it made her sick to her stomach.
"It's going to be okay," she suddenly heard.
Whirling around, she saw Joe standing off to the side in her running shoes, cheeks flushed and perspiration staining her shirt.
"Where did you come from?" "I went for a jog," Joe said. "I was trying to beat the heat, but obviously it didn't work. It's so steamy I could barely breathe, and I thought I was going to die of heat stroke. Even so, I think I'm doing better than you. You seem downright glum."
She motioned to the steps, and Katie scooted over. Joe took a seat beside her. "Alex and I had a fight last night."
"And?"
"I said something terrible to him."
"Did you apologize?"
"No," Katie answered. "He left before I could. I should have, but I didn't. And now..."
"What? You think it's too late?"
She squeezed Katie's knee.
"It's never too late to do the right thing.
Go over there and talk to him." Katie hesitated, her anxiety plain. "What if he won't forgive me?"
"Then he's not who you thought he was."
Katie drew her knees up, propping her chin on them. Joe peeled her shirt away from her skin, trying to fan herself before going on.
"He'll forgive you, though. You know that, right? He might be angry and you might have hurt his feelings, but he's a good man."
She smiled.
"Besides, every couple needs to argue now and then, just to prove that the relationship is strong enough to survive it."
That sounds like the counselor talking.
"It is, but it's also true. Long-term relationships, the ones that matter, are all about weathering the peaks and the valleys. And you are still thinking long-term, right?"
"Yes," Katie nodded. "I am. And you're right. Thanks." Joe patted Katie's leg and winked as she unfolded herself from the steps and stood.
"What are friends for, right?"
Katie squinted up. "Do you want some coffee? I was going to start a pot."
"Not this morning. Too hot. What I need is a glass of ice water and a cool shower. I feel like I'm melting."
"Are you going to the carnival today?"
"Maybe. I haven't decided yet. But if I do, I'll try to find you," she promised. "Now head on over there before you change your mind."
Katie sat on the steps a few minutes longer before retreating into the house. She showered and made herself a cup of coffee, but Joe was right. It was too hot to drink it. Instead, she changed into shorts and sandals before walking around to the back of the house and getting on her bicycle. Despite the recent downpour, the gravel road was already drying, and she was able to pedal without exerting much energy. Good thing. She had no idea how Joe had been able to jog in this heat, even first thing in the morning. Everything, it seemed, was trying to escape the heat. Normally there were squirrels or birds, but as she turned onto the main road, she saw no movement at all. On the road, traffic was light. A couple of cars zipped past, leaving fumes in their wake. Katie pedaled onward, and as she rounded a bend, the store came into view. Already there were half a dozen cars parked out front, regulars who came to eat biscuits. Talking to Joe had helped, she thought. A little, anyway. She was still anxious, but it had less to do with the Feldmans or other troubling memories than what she was going to say to Alex, or rather, what he was going to say to her in return. She pulled to a stop out front. A couple of older men were fanning themselves on the benches, and she walked past them toward the door. Behind the register, Joyce was ringing up a customer, and she smiled.
"Good morning, Katie," she said.
Katie quickly scanned the store. "Is Alex around?"
"He's upstairs with the kids. You know the way, right? The stairs out back."
Katie left the store and went around the side, toward the rear of the building. At the dock, a line of boats queued, waiting to fill up. She hesitated at the door before finally knocking. Inside, she could hear footfalls approaching. When the door swung open, Alex stood before her. She offered a tentative smile. "Hi," she said. He nodded, his expression unreadable. Katie cleared her throat. "I wanted to tell you that I'm sorry about what I said. I was wrong." His expression remained neutral.
"Okay," he said. "I appreciate the apology."
For a moment, neither of them said anything, and Katie suddenly wished she hadn't come. "I can go. I just need to know whether you still need me to watch the kids tonight." Again, he said nothing, and in the silence, Katie shook her head. When she turned to leave, she heard him take a step toward her.
"Katie." "Wait," he said.
He peeked over his shoulder at the kids before closing the door behind him.
"What you said last night," he began.
He trailed off, uncertain. "I didn't mean it," she said, her voice soft. "I don't know what got into me. I was upset about something else, and I took it out on you."
"I admit it. It bothered me. Not so much that you said it, but that you imagined me capable of that."
"I don't think that," Katie said. "I would never think that about you." He seemed to take that in, but she knew he had more to say.
"I want you to know that I value what we have right now. And more than anything, I want you to be comfortable, whatever that means. I'm sorry for making you feel like I was putting you on the spot. That wasn't what I was trying to do."
"Yes, you were." She gave him a knowing smile. "A little, anyway. But it's okay. I mean, who knows what the future might bring, right? Like tonight, for instance."
"Why? What happens tonight?"
She leaned against the door jamb. "Well, once the kids are asleep, and depending when you get back, it might be too late for me to ride back to my house. You might just find me in your bed." When he realized she wasn't kidding, he brought a hand to his chin in mock contemplation.
"That is a dilemma."
"Then again, traffic might be light and you'll get home early enough to bring me home."
"I'm generally a pretty safe driver. As a rule, I don't like to speed."
She leaned into him and breathed into his ear. "That's very conscientious of you."
"I try,"
he whispered, before their lips met. When he pulled back, he noticed half a dozen boaters watching them. He didn't care.
"How long did it take you to rehearse that speech?"
"I didn't. It just sort of came to me." He could still feel the remnants of their kiss.
"Have you had breakfast yet?"
he whispered. "No."
"Would you like to have cereal with me and the kids before we head off to the carnival?"
"Cereal sounds delicious." Chapter 34. North Carolina was ugly. A strip of road sandwiched between monotonous strands of pine trees and rolling hills. Along the highway, there were clusters of mobile homes and farmhouses and rotting barns overgrown with weeds. He left one interstate and got on another, turning toward Wilmington, and drank some more out of sheer boredom. As he passed through the unchanging landscape, he thought about Aaron, thought about what he was going to do when he found her. He hoped she would be at home when he arrived, but even if she was at work, it would only be a matter of time before she came home. The interstate wove past uninteresting towns with forgettable names. He was in Wilmington by 10. He drove through the city and turned onto a small, rural highway, heading south with the sun coming hard through the driver's side window. He put the gun in his lap and then back on the seat again and kept on going. And finally, he was there, in the town where she was living, Southport.
He drove slowly through town, detouring around a street fair, occasionally consulting the directions he'd printed out on the computer before he left. He pulled a shirt from the duffel bag and placed it over the gun to conceal it. It was a small town with neat, well-kept houses. Some were typically Southern, with wide porches and magnolia trees and American flags waving from poles. Others reminded him of homes in New England. There were mansions on the waterfront. Sunlight dappled the water in the spaces between them, and it was hot as hell, like a steam bath. Minutes later, he found the road where she lived. On the left up ahead was a general store, and he pulled in to buy some gas and a can of Red Bull. He stood behind a man buying charcoal and lighter fluid. At the register, he paid the old woman. She smiled and thanked him for coming, and commented in that nosy way that old women have that she hadn't seen him around before. He told her he was in town for the fair. As he turned back onto the road, his pulse raced at the knowledge that it wasn't far now. He rounded a bend and slowed the car. In the distance, a gravel road came into view. The directions indicated that he was supposed to turn, but he didn't stop the car. If Aaron was home, she would recognize his car immediately, and he didn't want that. Not until he had everything ready. He turned the car around, searching for an out-of-the-way place to park. There wasn't much. The store parking lot, maybe, but wouldn't someone notice if he parked it there? He passed the store again, scanning the area. The trees on the other side of the road might provide cover, or they might not. He didn't want to take the chance that someone would grow suspicious of an abandoned car in the trees. The caffeine was making him jittery, and he switched to vodka to settle his nerves. For the life of him, he couldn't find a place to stash the car. What the hell kind of a place was this? He turned around again, getting angry now. It shouldn't have been this hard, and he should have rented a car, but he hadn't, and now he couldn't find a way to get close enough to her without her noticing. The store was the only option, and he pulled back into the lot, stopping along the side of the building. It was at least a mile to the house from here, but he didn't know what else to do. He brooded before turning off the engine. When he opened the door, the heat enveloped him. He emptied the duffel bag, tossing his clothes on the back seat. Into the duffel bag went the gun, the ropes, the handcuffs, and the duct tape, and a spare bottle of vodka. Tossing the bag over his shoulder, he glanced around. No one was watching. He figured he could keep his car here for maybe an hour or two before someone got suspicious. He left the lot, and as he walked down the shoulder of the road, he could feel the pain starting in his head. The heat was ridiculous, like something alive. He walked the road, staring at the drivers and passing cars. He didn't see Aaron, even a brown-haired one. He reached the gravel road and turned. The road, dusty and potholed, seemed to lead nowhere until he finally spotted a pair of small cottages a half mile down. He felt his heart speed up. Aaron lived in one of them. He moved to the side of the road, hugging the trees, staying out of sight as much as possible. He was hoping for shade, but the sun was high and the heat remained constant. His shirt was drenched. Sweat dripped down his cheeks and plastered his hair to his skull. His head pounded, and he stopped for a drink, straight from the bottle. From a distance, neither of the cottages appeared occupied. Hell, neither one looked habitable. It was nothing like their house in Dorchester, with its shutters and corbels and red front door. On the cottage closest to him, the paint was peeling, and the planks were rotting in the corners. Moving forward, he watched the windows, looking for signs of movement. There was nothing. He didn't know which cottage was hers. He stopped to study them closely. Both were bad, but one looked practically abandoned. He moved toward the better one, angling away from the window.
It had taken 30 minutes to get here from the store. Once he surprised Aaron, he knew she'd try to get away. She wouldn't want to go with him. She would try to get away, might even try to fight, and he would tie her up and tape her mouth shut and then go get the car. Once he returned with the car, he would put her in the trunk until they were far away from this town. He reached the side of the house and flattened himself against it, staying away from the window. He listened for movement, the sound of opening doors or water running or dishes clattering, but heard nothing. His head still hurt, and he was thirsty. The heat poured down and his shirt was wet. He was breathing too fast, but he was so close to Aaron now, and he thought again how she'd left him and hadn't cared that he'd cried. She'd laughed behind his back, her and the man, whoever he was. He knew there had to be a man. She couldn't make it on her own. He peeked around the back of the house and saw nothing. He crept forward, watching. Ahead, there was a small window, and he took a chance and looked in. No lights on, but it was clean and tidy, with a dish towel draped over the kitchen sink, just like Aaron used to do. He silently approached the door and turned the knob. Unlocked. Holding his breath, he opened the door and stepped inside, pausing again to listen and hearing nothing. He crossed the kitchen and entered the living room, then the bedroom and bathroom. He cursed aloud, knowing she wasn't home. Assuming he was in the right home, of course. In the bedroom, he spied the chest of drawers and pulled the top one open. Finding a stack of her panties, he sifted through them, rubbed them between his thumb and forefinger. But it had been so long, he wasn't sure he could remember if they were the ones she had back home. The other clothes he didn't recognize, but they were her size. He recognized the shampoo and conditioner. He recognized the brand of toothpaste. In the kitchen, he rifled through the drawers, opening them one by one, until he found a utility bill. It was listed in the name of Katie Feldman, and now he leaned against the cupboard, staring at the name and feeling a sense of completion. The only problem was that she wasn't here, and he didn't know when she would return. He knew he couldn't leave his car at the store indefinitely, but all at once, he was just so tired. He wanted to sleep, needed to sleep. He'd driven all night and his head was pounding. Instinctively, he wandered back to her bedroom. She'd made the bed, and when he peeled back the cover, he could smell her scent in the sheets. He crawled into the bed, breathing deeply, breathing her in. He felt the tears flood his eyes as he realized how much he missed her and loved her, and that they could have been happy if she hadn't been so selfish. He couldn't stay awake, and he told himself that he would sleep for just a little while. Not long. Just enough so that when he came back later in the evening, his mind would be sharp and he wouldn't make mistakes, and he and Aaron could be husband and wife once more. Chapter 35. Alex, Katie, and the kids rode their bikes to the carnival because parking downtown was almost impossible. Trying to get home, once cars started pulling out, would be even worse. Booths displaying arts and crafts lined either side of the street, and the air was thick with the scent of hot dogs and burgers, popcorn, and cotton candy. On the main stage, a local band was playing Little Deuce Coop by the Beach Boys. There were sack races and a banner promising a watermelon eating contest later in the afternoon. Games of chance, too, throwing darts at balloons, tossing rings around bottles, sinking three shots with a basketball to win a stuffed animal. The Ferris wheel at the far end of the park towered above all of it, drawing families like a beacon. Alex stood in line to buy tickets while Katie followed behind with the kids, heading toward the bumper cars and tilt-a-whirl. Long lines were everywhere. Mothers and fathers clung to the hands of children, and teens clustered in groups. The air sounded with the roar of generators and clacking noises as the rides went round and round. The world's tallest horse could be viewed for $1. Another $1 bought admission to the tent next door, which housed the smallest horse. Ponies, walking in circles and tethered to a wheel, were hot and tired, their heads hanging low. The kids were antsy and wanted to ride everything, so Alex purchased a small fortune in tickets. The tickets went fast, because most of the rides required 3 or 4. The cumulative cost was ridiculous, and Alex tried to make them last by insisting they do other things as well. They watched a man juggle bowling pins and cheered for a dog that could walk across a tightrope. They had pizza for lunch at one of the local restaurants, eating inside to escape the heat, and listened to a country western band play a number of songs. Afterward, they watched people racing jet skis in the Cape Fear River before heading back to the rides. Kristen wanted cotton candy, and Josh got a press-on tattoo. And so the hours passed, in a blur of heat and noise and small-town pleasures. Kevin woke 2 hours later, his body slick with sweat, his stomach knotted with cramps. His heat-induced dreams had been vivid and colorful, and it was hard to remember where he was. His head felt like it was splitting in two. He staggered from the bedroom and into the kitchen, slaking his thirst directly from the tap. He was dizzy and weak, and felt more tired than when he lay down in the first place. But he couldn't linger. He shouldn't have slept at all, and he went to the bedroom and remade the bed so she wouldn't know he'd been there. He was about to leave when he remembered the tuna casserole he'd spied in her refrigerator earlier, when he'd searched her kitchen. He was ravenous, and he remembered that she hadn't cooked him dinner in months. It had to be close to 100 degrees in this airless shack, and when he opened the refrigerator, he stood for a long minute in the cool air as it spilled out. He grabbed the tuna casserole and rummaged through the drawers until he found a fork. After peeling back the plastic wrap, he took a bite and then a second one. Eating did nothing for the pain in his head, but his stomach felt better, and the cramps began to subside. He could have eaten all of the casserole, but he forced himself to take just one more bite before putting it back in the refrigerator. She couldn't know that he'd been here. He rinsed the fork, dried it, and put it back in the drawer. He straightened the towel and checked the bed again, making sure it looked the way it had when he entered. Satisfied, he left the house and headed up the gravel road toward the store. The roof of the car was scalding to the touch, and when he opened the door, it felt like a furnace. No one was in the parking lot, too hot to be outside, sweltering, without a cloud or hint of breeze. Who, in God's name, would want to live in a place like this? In the store, he grabbed a bottle of water and drank it while standing near the coolers. He paid for the empty container, and the old woman threw it out. She asked him if he enjoyed the carnival. He told the nosy old woman that he had. Back in the car, he drank more vodka, not caring that it was now the temperature of a cup of coffee, as long as it made the pain go away. It was too hot to think, and he could have been on his way back to Dorchester if Aaron had been home. Maybe when he brought Aaron back and Bill realized how happy they were together, he would give him his job back. He was a good detective, and Bill needed him. As he drank, the throbbing in his temples began to recede, but he started to see two of everything when he knew there should be only one. He needed to keep his mind sharp, but the pain and the heat were making him sick, and he didn't know what to do. He started the car and turned onto the main road, heading back to downtown Southport. Many streets were closed off, and he made countless detours before he found a spot to park. No shade for miles, just sun and endless, stifling heat. He felt like he might vomit. He thought about Aaron and where she might be. Ivan's? At the carnival? He should have called to ask whether she was working today, should have stopped at a hotel last night. No reason to rush, because she wasn't at home.
but he hadn't known that then. And it made him angry to think she was probably laughing about that too. Laughing and laughing at poor Kevin Tierney while she cheated on him with another man.
He changed his shirt and tucked the gun into the waistband of his jeans and started toward the waterfront. He knew that's where he'd find Ivan's, because he'd searched for the location on the computer. He knew he was taking a risk if he went there, and he turned around twice. But he had to find her. Had to make sure she was still real. He'd been in her house and inhaled her scent, but it wasn't enough. Crowds of people were everywhere. The streets reminded him of a county fair without the pigs and horses and cows. He bought a hot dog and tried to eat it, but his stomach rebelled and he threw most of it away. Weaving among the people, he spotted the waterfront in the distance, and then Ivan's. His progress through the throngs was excruciatingly slow. His mouth was dry by the time he reached the door of the restaurant. Ivan's was packed, people waiting outside the entrance for tables. He should have brought a hat and sunglasses, but he hadn't been thinking. He knew she would recognize him instantly, but he worked his way to the door anyway and stepped inside. He spotted a waitress, but it wasn't Aaron. Saw another, but she wasn't Aaron either. The hostess was young and harried and trying to figure out where to put the next group of customers. It was loud. People talking, forks clanking against plates, glasses sloshing in the bus tubs. Loud and confusing, and the damn pounding in his head wouldn't go away. His stomach burned. "Is Aaron working today?" he called out to the hostess, raising his voice above the noise. She blinked at him in confusion.
"Who?"
"Katie," he said. "I meant Katie. Katie Feldman."
"No," the hostess shouted back. "She's off. She's working tomorrow, though."
She nodded toward the windows.
"She's probably out there somewhere, along with everyone else. I thought I saw her walk past here earlier."
Kevin turned and left, bumping into people as he went, ignoring it. Outside, he paused at a sidewalk vendor. He bought a baseball hat and a pair of inexpensive sunglasses, and then he began to walk. The Ferris wheel went round and round. Alex and Josh in one seat, and Kristen and Katie in another, hot wind in their faces. Katie had her arm draped over Kristen's shoulders, knowing that despite Kristen's smile, she was nervous about the height. As the seat rotated to its peak, unveiling a panorama of the town, Katie realized that while she wasn't exactly thrilled with the height either, she was more concerned with the Ferris wheel itself. The thing looked like it was held together with bobby pins and chicken wire, even if it had supposedly passed inspection earlier that morning. She wondered if Alex had been telling the truth about the inspection, or if he'd heard her saying aloud whether it might be dangerous. It was too late to worry about it now, she supposed. So instead, she occupied herself by staring at the throngs of people below. The carnival had become even more crowded as the afternoon wore on, but aside from boating, there wasn't a lot to do in Southport. It was a sleepy little town, and she surmised that an event like this was probably the highlight of the year. The Ferris wheel slowed and stopped, stranding them as the first of the passengers got out and others crawled on. It rotated a bit, and she found herself scrutinizing the crowd more closely. Kristen seemed more relaxed and was doing the same. She recognized a couple of people eating snow cones as regulars at Ivan's, and she wondered how many others were out there. Her eyes began to travel from group to group, and for some reason she remembered that she used to do the same thing when she first started working at Ivan's, back when she was watching for Kevin. Kevin walked past the booths that lined either side of the street, just wandering and trying to think like Aaron. He should have asked the hostess if she'd seen Aaron with a man, because he knew she wouldn't be at the carnival alone. It was hard to keep reminding himself that she might have short brown hair because she'd cut and dyed it. He should have had the pedophile at the other precinct get a copy of the driver's license photo
but he hadn't been thinking at the time, and it didn't matter now, because he knew where she lived, and he would go back. He could feel the gun in his waistband, pressing against his skin. It felt uncomfortable, pinching his flesh, and it was hot under the ball hat, especially since it was pulled low and tight. His head felt like it would explode. He moved around groups of people, lines that formed. Arts and crafts, decorated pine cones, stained glass in frames, wind chimes, old-fashioned toys carved from wood. People were stuffing their faces with food, pretzels and ice cream, nachos, cinnamon rolls. He saw babies in strollers and remembered again that Aaron wanted to have a baby. He decided he would give her one. A girl or a boy, it didn't matter, but he preferred a boy because girls were selfish and wouldn't appreciate the life he gave them. Girls were like that. People talked and whispered all around him, and he thought some of them were staring at him, like Coffee and Ramirez used to do. He ignored them, focused on his search. Families, teens with their arms around one another, a guy in a sombrero. A couple of the carnival workers stood near a streetlight, smoking, thin and tattooed, with bad teeth. Probably drug users, with long records. They gave him a bad feeling. He was a good detective and knew how to read people, and he didn't trust them, but they did nothing as he brushed past them. He veered left and right, working his way steadily through the crowd, studying people's faces. He paused while an overweight couple waddled past him, eating corn dogs, their faces red and blotchy. He hated fat people, thought they were weak and had no discipline. People who complained about their blood pressure and diabetes and heart problems and whined about the cost of medicine but couldn't summon the strength to put the fork down. Aaron was always thin, but her breasts were big, and now she was here with another man who fondled them at night, and the thought made him burn inside. He hated her, but he wanted her too, loved her. It was hard to keep it straight in his head. He'd been drinking too much, and it was just so damn hot. Why had she moved to a place as hellish as this? He wandered among the carnival rides and noticed the Ferris wheel up ahead. He moved closer, bumping into a man in a tank top, ignoring his muttered outrage. He checked the seats on the ride, his gaze flashing on every face. Aaron wasn't there, or in the line, either. He moved on, walking in the heat among the fat people, looking for skinny Aaron and the man who touched her breasts at night. With every step, he thought about the Glock. The swings, spinning clockwise, were a big hit with the kids. They'd ridden them twice in the morning, and after the Ferris wheel, Kristen and Josh begged to ride them once more. There were only a few tickets left, and Alex agreed, explaining that after this last ride, they would have to go home. He wanted to have time to shower and eat, and maybe relax before he had to drive to Raleigh. Despite his best efforts, he couldn't stop thinking about Katie's earlier suggestive remark. She seemed to sense the direction of his thoughts, because he'd caught her staring at him a couple of times, a provocative smile playing at the corner of her lips. Now she stood beside him, smiling up at the kids. He scooted closer, slipping his arm around her, and felt her lean into him. He said nothing, for there was no need for words, and she said nothing either. Instead, she tilted her head, resting it against his shoulder, and Alex was struck by the notion that there was nothing better in the world. Aaron wasn't at the tilt-a-whirl, or the maze of mirrors, or the haunted house. He watched from the ticket line, trying to blend in, wanting to see her before she spotted him. He had the advantage because he knew she was here, and she didn't know about him. But sometimes people got lucky, and strange things happened. He flashed on the memory of Karen Feldman, and the day she revealed Aaron's secret. He wished he hadn't left his vodka in the car. There didn't seem to be anywhere to buy more, not a bar in sight. He hadn't even seen a booth selling beer, which he didn't like, but would have bought if he had no other choice. The smell of food made him nauseated and hungry at the same time, and he could feel the sweat plastering his shirt to his back and armpits. He walked past the games of chance, run by con artists. Waste of money because the games were rigged, but morons packed around them. He searched faces. No Aaron. He wandered toward the other rides. There were kids in bumper cars, people fidgeting in the line. Beyond that were the swings. He started in that direction. He circumvented a cluster of people, straining for a better view. The swings had begun to slow, but Kristen and Josh were still grinning with excitement. Alex was right about needing to call it a day. The heat had drained Katie, and it would be nice to be able to cool off for a while. If there was one bad thing about the cottage, well, there was actually more than one bad thing, she supposed. It was that it didn't have air conditioning. She'd gotten used to keeping the windows open at night, but it didn't help much. The ride came to a stop, and Josh unhooked the chain and jumped down.